Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, over the next half hour, we talk with one of the cardinals-to-be who will be receiving his red zucchetto and ring from Pope Benedict at next week's consistory. He's the American who heads the Vatican's highest tribunal, Archbishop Raymond Burke. And we step into the Pope's Apostolic Library. A new exhibit opens the doors, virtually, to the prestigious institution, which is off-limits to all but scholars and qualified students. Since 2008, he's been in charge of the Vatican's Supreme Court of sorts, the Apostolic Signatura, and soon he'll be one of 24 new cardinals to be created in the Vatican by Pope Benedict November 20th. 62-year-old Raymond Leo Burke was the Archbishop of St. Louis and earlier the Bishop of La Crosse, Wisconsin, before Pope Benedict appointed him head of the Signatura. A canon lawyer, the cardinal designate, worked for the Vatican Tribunal from 1989 to 1994 and was named a member of the body in 2006. He has also served on the Roman Rota, the Church's central appeals court. In this, the first of a two-part interview, I spoke to him about his life and his career, beginning with his elevation to cardinal. An exciting time, to say the least. Let's listen.
It certainly is. I'm very grateful to our Holy Father for the confidence that he has placed in me, and only am praying that I will be equal to what he needs from me.
So I'd like to kind of look back at perhaps what might be one of the most important moments of your life, and that was the moment that you became a priest. Did you have a light bulb moment where you just had a flash and you said, oh, I'm going to become a priest?
No, I never really did. From the time I was small, I was quite attracted to the priesthood. I came from a good Catholic family where the practice of our faith was very important, and my parents were very close to the parish priest, who was actually a native of Ireland, but he had been our parish priest for many years. And so from the time I was small, even like in first and second grade, I would talk about it. And then when I began to serve Holy Mass when I was in fourth grade, the attraction became ever stronger because I was so close to the most important activity of the priest, namely the offering of the Mass. In my home diocese of La Crosse in Wisconsin, we had a minor seminary, so when I finished eighth grade, I was 14 years old, I entered our minor seminary, and that was a very positive experience. And over the years, I continued in the seminary, growing ever more in my desire to be a priest. Not that I didn't think of doing other things, and certainly during the late 60s and early 70s, which were my last years in college and the years of theology, there was a lot of turmoil in the seminary, and which naturally raised questions. But the Lord gave me the grace to persevere. And so in 1975, I presented myself to the bishop, having completed my seminary studies here in Rome for ordination, and was ordained a priest. And I have to say that it's a great gift that God has given to me, for which I remain always grateful.
Can I ask, when you said there was some turmoil in the seminary, was that the period of the Vietnam War and there was a lot of controversy, a lot of protests going on at that time?
Yes, well, I suppose 1968 is the symbolic year of the Paris student riots, but that whole rebellion against authority entered into the seminary too, and in an unfortunate coincidence coincided with the implementation of the reforms of the Second Vatican Council. And what happened, in my judgment, was more of this rebellion of authority got involved than the actual reading and studying of the documents of the council and following them. And so they're simply, I remember from one year to the next, the discipline in the seminary practically evaporated, and you can imagine that in the whole atmosphere of the times that there was turmoil. That's the long and short of it.
And if we go a little bit farther back, I mean, was there a moment in your childhood that you'd say some sort of an anecdote of an incident in your childhood that maybe changed the course of your life?
Probably had the greatest influence on me. When I was 7 years old, my father became very ill and was eventually diagnosed with a brain tumor. And he died when I was 8 years old in July of 1956. And that obviously was a very difficult time for the whole family. I'm the youngest of six children, and my mother remained very strong, but through the whole illness and still trying to take care of us children, it was a big challenge. But what made a lasting impression on me was that in those days, when people were seriously ill, they were at home more, and the priest would come frequently to hear my father's confession and to bring him Holy Communion. And when the priest came, we would go to the door and meet him with a lighted candle, and everyone kept silence because we were in the presence of the Blessed Sacrament. He would come into my father's room, and first everyone would leave the room, and he would hear my father's confession, and then he would give him Holy Communion. And I saw how this was sustaining my father very much, and how also it gave me so much comfort. And then the priest afterwards would come and sit down and visit with us children, and in his own very fatherly way would try to get our minds off of the illness of our father and to entertain us with stories about Ireland and so forth. And that simply made a very, very deep impression upon me. And I would think that's probably one of the most significant events in my childhood with regard to my priestly vocation.
And then what made you decide to go into canon law, to study canon law?
I actually didn't decide. My bishop decided it. When I was studying philosophy and theology, I enjoyed my studies very much, and actually I had hoped one day to do graduate studies in theology. I did do a fourth year of seminary studies, which were graduate studies, but then the bishop asked me to come home to begin work in the diocese. Our diocese was very short of priests in those years, and so I did. I returned home, and I worked in the parish, and then I also, for the last 3 years that I was in the cathedral parish as assistant rector, I also taught in the high school. And at the end of the fifth year, 5 years in the parish and 3 years teaching, the bishop called me, I remember very well, on Holy Thursday afternoon, and told me that he was reassigning me in the fall to graduate studies in canon law at the Gregorian University. And that was his decision. In fact, in a way that was really rather impertinent, I questioned him about it, not in a disrespect way. I thanked him first, and then I said I wondered if maybe I should continue teaching for a while longer. And I always remember what he said to me. He said, "I didn't think I was asking you." That was an important lesson in obedience. In other words, the bishop was calling me and giving me an assignment, and the response on my part should have been, "Yes, bishop, I'll do that." And I did it, and I have to say that when I first began studying canon law, there wasn't a great deal of enthusiasm about it. It wasn't, in my years in the seminary, the teaching of canon law was very sparse, and it was that whole period between the two codes, and also if the rebelliousness of the late 60s and early 70s can be seen anywhere, it can certainly be seen in a kind of disregard and disdain for canon law. I have to say I never disdained it, but I certainly didn't. There weren't a lot of examples of a great esteem for canon law. But thanks be to God, when I arrived at the Gregorian University, there were some wonderful professors, and one in particular became a mentor of mine. And with time, I began to really understand the importance of canon law and to enter very deeply into the study. And I'm very happy to this day that the bishop made that decision, even if at the time it didn't appear to me to be what I really wanted to do.
So you think it was rather providential in a way?
I do. I have to say that about my whole priestly life, and I don't mean this in some kind of pietistic way, but I've tried since that time to always do whatever the bishop asked, and I have to say that I have never been unhappy, and I've seen so much providence in all of the different assignments which I've had, none of which I must say I could have foreseen when I was in the seminary.
But you must miss teaching a bit.
I do. I enjoyed teaching very much. I come from a family of teachers. My mother was a teacher, and I love teaching very much, and that was probably one of the hardest things to give up when I came to do the studies in canon law, and even now returning to Rome as prefect of the Apostolic Signatura, I don't have those normal occasions to teach the faithful that I would have had as a diocesan bishop. So we learn in the priestly life, as all members of the faithful learn in whatever their vocation, that sometimes you have to give up good things in order to do what you're asked.
Do you feel like you've been called here for some reason, a specific reason? Sometimes I feel that there's, you know, our destiny is really sometimes laid out for us.
Well, I see my call as being prefect of the Supreme Tribunal of the Apostolic Signatura. It's a work for which I was prepared through my studies and through my experience. I had served in the Signatura from 1989 until 1995, and so the Holy Father called me here. In one way, it was a surprise because of the gravity of the responsibility of being prefect. But in another way, I understand that it's a work that I can do, and the Holy Father's asking me to do, and I'm happy to do it.
You are obviously a very busy man. You're, like you said, you're the prefect of the Apostolic Signatura, but you're also with the Congregation for Bishops and the Congregation for the Causes of Saints. So it seems like you're constantly being asked to discern what is best for the Church and who you think are the best models, role models for the faithful. What would you say are the challenges that these various positions pose for you?
Well, both the Congregation for Bishops and the Congregation for Causes of Saints are, being a member of those congregations is a major responsibility. I feel it especially strongly in the Congregation for Bishops, which were asked to study extensive documentation on each candidate who was being proposed for appointment as a bishop, and that we have to give our judgment in the matter. Clearly, the Holy Father's judgment is what makes the bishop, but he looks to us who are the members of the congregation to give him wise counsel. And when you consider that a bishop is going to be a shepherd of a numerous flock, it's going to have responsibility for so many souls, you have a very strong sense of needing to do your very best to study these documents very carefully and to give the Holy Father the best possible counsel. And in a certain way, no less for the causes of saints. You want to understand fully the heroic virtue of these saints, the possible miracles that are attributed to those who are being considered for beatification or canonization. And here, once again, the Holy Father is looking to us for counsel, and it's a big responsibility. But we're trained as canonists, at least those of us who have been involved in tribunals and in diocesan governance, we're trained to study matters and to make a prudential judgment. And so there's a certain preparation for it, but you never lose the sense of the gravity of it and of the need to keep yourself always alert. You can't become, how should we say, careless about these matters, but you need to give each case the fullest possible attention.
And a warm thanks and congratulations there to Cardinal-designate Raymond Burke. You can hear part two of my interview with him in next Tuesday's program, November 23rd. Do tune in then. We're inside the Pope's Apostolic Library, and everyone is invited to be quiet. We turn our heads from one side of the frescoed reading room to the other to see disgruntled scholars looking up from their work as we walk in. Our video guide whisks us back through space and time, explaining how, from verbal evolution, man first invented the written word, and how, for centuries, to protect and preserve the world's rich, evolving patrimony of handwritten tomes and printed volumes, the Vatican has kept ahead of the times, employing some of the most technically advanced instruments known to man. A state-of-the-art microchip system ensures no volume in the library can get lost amid the mile after mile of bookshelves, or worse, pilfered from the centuries-old institution. The finest photographic equipment and digital scanners, not yet even on the market, record and reproduce the tiniest details of manuscripts dating back to the 3rd or the 4th century. But no, we're not really inside the Papal Library. Only accredited scholars and qualified students can get in there. We're inside the next best thing, a physical room in a virtual world, recreating the Vatican Library's 16th century frescoed Sistine Hall reading room, complete with wooden tables, chairs, and lecterns. Here, like real scholars, we can slip on white gloves and examine exact replicas of ancient illustrated manuscripts on subjects that vary from the nutritional and therapeutic properties of herbs to religious texts, including one of the world's oldest Bibles, the 4th century Codex Vaticanus B, geographical maps, and a guide to falconry. These are only a sampling of the library's vast collection of some 150,000 manuscripts and more than 1.5 million printed books. In fact, if you were to line up all the institution's books in a row, they'd lead you straight to Rome's Fiumicino Airport and back, a trip covering some 60 kilometers. The library also possesses some 1,300 early block print volumes, and one of the world's most important collections of coins and medallions, numbering some 300,000 items. We're in the first room of a very special exhibit, celebrating the September reopening of the Vatican Library after 3 years of restoration. It is open to visitors in the Braccio Carlo Magno Hall, to the left of St. Peter's Square, through January 31st. The exhibition is comprised of several sections, including history of the library, manuscripts, drawings and paintings, printed volumes, prints, numismatics, archival services, and restoration and photographic departments. An audio tour accompanies the visitor in one of 5 languages through a series of thematic exhibit rooms, many of which are enhanced by audiovisual effects. Among the items on display are important historical manuscripts dating from the early Christian centuries to the modern era, rare incunabula or block printed books where woodcuts were used to print entire pages, hand-illustrated manuscripts and drawings and prints by master artists, and a selection of rare coins and medals, some dating to the very time of Jesus himself. Perhaps one is among the coins Judas received for his betrayal. But the collection also extends to the Middle East and Asia, with a handsomely illustrated 13th century Arabic love story of Bayad and Riyad, and from Palestine, an 11th century Melkite lectionary in Aramaic, the language Jesus himself spoke, and from Burma, a 19th century illustrated life of Buddha. 80% of the objects and texts on display are original manuscripts, volumes and sketches, and prints from some of Europe's most renowned artists from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance. Here you'll find a first edition volume of Piranesi's Scenes of Rome, a self-portrait by Gian Lorenzo Bernini, and poetic verses and sketches by Michelangelo, not to mention a bizarre work by Botticelli depicting scenes from the Divine Comedy. Vatican Library restorers are also present at the exhibit to explain how they preserve and repair centuries-old codices and torn or dog-eared pages, damaged bindings, and book covers. Father Cesar Attuire is the chief executive officer of the pilgrimage tour operator Opera Romana Pellegrinaggi, which collaborated in the realization of the exhibit. He explains why it focuses on a history open to the future.
If you think of a place like the library, the Vatican Library, it's a place where people, academics, research students from all over the world come in to study. And it's kind of reserved to a very small number of people. Yet at the same time, inside the Vatican Library, we do have texts that are not only religious, but they are cultural, scientific, and historical. And they have an importance basically for the rest of the world, because even some scientific discoveries started with the materials we have in the Vatican Library. Now, the question was, okay, how can we open this to the general public? Get people who do not know about the existence of the library, and also, to some extent, also sort of like, remove some of the myths about the Vatican Library, because sometimes when you talk about the Vatican Library, people start thinking about secret documents,
the secret archives of the Vatican.
Yeah, secret archives, and that you're going to find, I don't know what kind of, you're going to reveal some kind of grave error or sin of the church, but there's nothing like that in the Vatican Library. So we thought we would, have this exhibition where people could get to know the Vatican Library, get to know what is done in there and the sort of material that is kept in there. And at the same time, there is something that is very interesting, and that leads me to the title of the exhibition, which is A History That Is Open to the Future. The Vatican Library, since its creation, has always been avant-garde, a leader in modern technology. So much so that even today, the technology that is used to preserve, conserve, and even promote the study of the ancient texts is the most up-to-date technology. And for that matter, it's not just, you just can't think of the Vatican Library like this kind of dark room where you have monks with hoods sitting down studying texts that nobody can understand. No, this is a modern place where people try to gather information regarding the past, regarding even scientific research, historical research, biblical research with regard to the past, and then see how this can be made relevant to the future.
I am going to take my kids to see it because I was so impressed by the video. It's really interactive. You can touch the manuscripts. You have videos. You have audio. You're listening to a tour guide give you the tour of the facility. It's really engaging, even for young people.
Right. Well, that was what we tried to do, to make it as interactive as possible and also use, the modern technology that we have at our disposal today. And we've introduced a number of topics in there. For example, something that I found extremely amusing is the part that is dedicated to coins, to money. And if you visit that particular area, where you see is in 7 minutes you get the whole history of money trade, starting from when money did not exist. And there was barter trade, people used to exchange goods, to when they started using coins, to the plastic, and now to digital use, because these days with a computer you can do anything. Now, what does that really mean? And how can you interpret this in the light of the gospel? Secondly, there is a very interesting calculation there of how much did the 30 silver coins Judas received when he sold Jesus, how much are they worth today? And according to the analysis that was made by the guys and the experts in the Vatican Library, we're talking of something around 12,000 euros, which would be around $15,000. That's what he sold Jesus Christ for. And these are interesting.
And some of the coins that might be on display there could even have been the coins that Judas himself received.
Absolutely. There are, I don't know whether they're the exact coins, but there are coins taken from the money that was being used in the temple at that time. And, they even explain why. For example, in the gospel, you read that Jesus, when he went violent in the temple and he threw all the money changers out, one would ask why, but why should we have money changers in the temple? And there you find the explanation, because in the rest of Palestine, the money that was being used was of Greek origin. Whereas the temple being a sacred ground, the priests in the temple would not allow pagan money in. And for that matter, they had their own autochthonous money. And that is why people had to change money coming into the temple. And that's why Jesus was so fed up with these guys. He threw all their tables away and told them not to transform, the temple of the Lord into a thief's den, basically.
What is your relationship with the Vatican?
Well, Opera Romana Pellegrinaggi was created as an organization of the Diocese of Rome. And the Diocese of Rome is part of the Holy See, because at the end of the day, the Pope is Pope because he's Bishop of Rome. And so the Vicariato, as it's called, is part of the establishment of the Holy See. Now, the thing is this. Our actual statutes are found in the document that was created by the Pope to create the diocesan reality of Rome, which is Ecclesia in Urbe, that is the name of the document. And in that document, the Pope actually establishes the existence of the Opera Romana Pellegrinaggi as an organization responsible for receiving pilgrims coming to Rome and also for taking pilgrims to the holy sites around the world. And that is why we form part of the organization of the Holy See.
You look like you've taken a lot of personal satisfaction out of this exhibit. How did you get involved in the actual creation of this exhibit?
Well, we've been in contact with the Vatican Library. We organize other visits to different areas of the Vatican as part of our activities, Opera Romana Pellegrinaggi. And we have been in touch with the Vatican Library. And when they did tell us that they were going to come out with this, the idea of coming out with an exhibition, I thought, well, this could be an interesting occasion to do a little bit of mediation, because here, on the one hand, we have very competent academics, librarians, and at the same time, we are involved with the general public. So how can I take this wealth and help them to translate it into a language that is accessible to the general public? And that is how we started working together, and this is the end result, I think, is quite good, really.
Father Cesar Atuire is the CEO of the pilgrimage tour operator Opera Romana Pellegrinaggi. The exhibit in the Braccio Carlo Magno Hall runs through January 31st. That concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.